Now, I am assuming that for tonight you have read the class notes, pages 28 to 33, and IBRI report number 12. Before we get into discussion, let me say just a few things, just a few highlight things. In Systematic Theology 1, we discussed general revelation and special revelation. In general revelation, both external and internal, God shows us something of His glory. He reveals something of His handiwork, His characteristics through His creative activity. IBRI report number 12 assumes both kinds of revelation in terms of information, truth, knowledge that we can gain in regard to what God did and what God does. So that the question then arises, what can we learn from the universe around us and from ourselves as created beings about God's creative activity? What can we learn then from Scripture? The general way, or generally the way that that question is approached and has been approached for a long time, at least in evangelical circles, is that the revelation in Scripture is not only held to be determinative of the answers to the discussion, but also the only revelation. So that the revelation of God in nature, what we call the general revelation, is virtually discounted. That is, as something from which we can get any information, any knowledge, any truth concerning what God has done and what God is doing. That I consider to be an egregious error. Now, sometimes in this discussion, which you know is very controversial, sometimes in this discussion, two books are spoken of, the book of nature and the book of Scripture. And the task for the scientist and the theologian working together, that is, a Christian who has devoted himself or herself to the study of some scientific discipline or disciplines, and is doing it for the glory of God as an occupation, as a life work. And the theologian who studies the Scripture and attempts to develop constructs, tries to understand what the Scripture teaches as a whole and relate that not only to other teachings of Scripture, but relate that to the whole of life and the whole of activity. Those two working together, presumably, if God reveals Himself in the book of nature and in the book of Scripture, presumably they ought to be able to work together in the interface, and they ought to be able to say something meaningful both to each other and to other Christians. Now, too often it has not been the case that they have been able to do that. That is extremely unfortunate also. Now, sometimes it's because, frankly, the theologian or the biblical scholar, the student of Scripture, however you want to phrase that formally or informally, has been suspicious of the kinds of methods and the results which the scientist has employed or to which the scientist has come. And as a result, there tends to be a standoff, and they tend to fight against each other, and very little good comes out of that. It's not even a question of iron sharpening iron. It's a question there of a controversy which really doesn't increase light and understanding. There's a great deal of heat usually in it, and there's a great deal of misunderstanding, and sometimes there's even vilification, invidious comparisons and statements made about the person who happens to be on the other side of the issue. Again, I deem that to be very unfortunate. However, there are some limitations drawn by Scripture and Scripture's teaching itself, so that in a lot of the recent literature, we find that certain people who have committed their lives to science and are attempting to maintain a Christian testimony have felt very, impatient about the way things have generally gone at the interface between science and Scripture. And they felt impatient with the way that understanding on the part of theologians, biblical scholars, students of Scripture have achieved in terms of how Scripture is to be used vis-a-vis the data from general revelation. As a result, as you know, and this is such a controversial area, we have what are constantly referred to as older and younger students of Scripture, or theologians, or scientists. And we have organizations which have developed, which have formalized and institutionalized certain points of view. And once those points of view have become institutionalized, it's become very, very difficult to maintain any kind of back and forth dialogue between them in terms of contributions that each may make to the understanding of the other. For a long time now, I have felt that it would be valuable to be able to gather together a number of professional scientists who were committed to the authority and inerrancy of Scripture, and a number of theologians and biblical scholars, especially those who had control of the languages and could do exegesis, and be able to gather them together and to hold some sort of a colloquium, if you wish, a symposium, some kind of a gathering, the name is not important what it could be called, in which they could share their insights, in which they could talk to each other, in which they could benefit perhaps from one another, and perhaps develop better understanding of the whole problem of, on the one hand, attempting to understand what Scripture teaches, and on the other hand, attempting to understand what we can learn from the record of God's creative activity. I have, over the years, taught a course in creationism and evolutionism. It's called creation. It's called Evolution and Special Creation in the catalog. And I've taken students to the American Museum of Natural History, and from time to time, I've had students who have lived such sheltered lives in regard to the interface question that when they looked at the dinosaurs, the skeletal remains, or the casts of the skeletal remains that are mounted there in the American Museum of Natural History, they had a hard time assimilating that data. They've had a tough time grasping what they're seeing and fitting it in to their whole worldview, because, frankly, they have always been exposed to the idea that that's all a lot of applesauce, and it's all a bunch of things that have been thought up by non-believing evolutionists who reject the Bible, and they are the ones who believe in dinosaurs and that sort of thing. And it's very difficult, of course, to argue with actual finds found in the matrix. It's easy to say, oh, that's just a cast. Of course, you could ask the second question, it's a cast of what? You know, you could ask that. But in any case, unless it's made out of whole cloth, but in any case, if remains are found in matrix and dug out of dinosaurs, it's pretty difficult to argue with that, unless, of course, some unbelieving scientists have planted them in the matrix, which most people wouldn't believe anyway. But still, they have a hard time with that kind of data. What it shows is that there's been some kind of an effort to protect Christians from evolutionism and evolutionary theory so that they wouldn't be harmed in their faith. Now, may I respectfully say that the Bible doesn't need that kind of protection. Christianity doesn't need that kind of protection. Christianity has nothing to fear from truth. It has nothing to fear from reality. Absolutely nothing. And I think too long that there's been a cover-up, a cover-over, whatever you want to call it, in which, in the interests of not confusing Christians, preserving their faith, many times truth has gone by the board. And also, I think it's a very unhappy situation that all of God's general revelation in nature has therefore been accorded a kind of a status which produces no effect whatsoever in faith. We can't even speak of a general faith as a response, a believing response to general revelation. And as a result, these Christians don't see God's creative hand in the external universe. Or they may see him now and then in some distant way, for instance, in stars, or they may see him in the beauty of a sunset, or they may see him in this or that or the other thing which is highly touted as an evidence of God's design and God's control and so forth. But generally speaking, they don't see God in his creative activity in the creation around them, especially as they look toward the past. And they don't think they can gain any information about what God did except that which is found in Scripture. That's unfortunate, because if you look back in history, and here I'm talking about geological history and paleontological history, the history of ancient life, what you really are going to find there is a record of what God has done, what God has actually created, and what has happened since that particular time. And that record is a record which is constantly being uncovered and exposed. The Christians can take part in uncovering that record, can find the data for themselves and ask, what does this mean? How do I plug it into my understanding of Scripture? Now, one thing that has happened, which is very unfortunate, theologians have sometimes given the impression that when we study Scripture, what we get from Scripture is absolute truth, unmediated by human understanding, as though what we did in Scripture was really and simply to read out of Scripture absolute truth without any input of our human understanding as far as interpretation is concerned. The real truth, of course, is that there are a number of steps between the Scripture and our understanding in terms of translation, in terms of hermeneutical, that is, interpretational principles, in terms of all kinds of constructs that we make and put together. And so there's quite a process that comes from Scripture to my mind and my understanding. And that frequently has also been covered over, that is, that such a process has to take place and does take place. And on the other side, there's also a process of understanding. And between the data that we find, say, in the record of the rocks and our understanding, there are quite a few steps as well. And you've also got all kinds of obstacles to overcome. You've got all sorts of problems that you have to deal with in terms of understanding what that means when you find something of that nature. Well, what it turns out to be then is that instead of having absolute truth unmediated by our human understanding coming from Scripture, and having only relative truth mediated by all kinds of presuppositions and all kinds of interpretational problems coming from nature and the record of God's activity in nature, and immediately then seeing the difference between absolute and relative truth, giving the palm of victory to absolute truth. Instead of that, what we really got here is absolute truth mediated by our understanding as it passes through the grid of our understanding. And again, an absolute truth in the data itself as far as what God has done, but mediated again to us through our understanding. And the problem that we now face is how to put these two bodies of data together in such a way as to show to ourselves and to other Christians what God has actually done in his creative activity. So I think, first of all, I want to make that point, that both are necessary for a full understanding, and by full I mean as fully as we are capable of understanding in a limited way, an understanding of God's creative work, what he has actually done. Now, some put it one way and some put it another. Some would say, what you've got in Scripture are general, broad brushstrokes. And then what you've got in the record of God's creative activity in history are a lot of details, and you fill in the broad brushstrokes with details, but the broad brushstrokes are determinative. They're controlling. That's very useful, that kind of thought, that kind of construct. Others are not satisfied with that, and in the recent literature it's become very apparent that they're unsatisfied with that, especially those who are working as scientists. They don't feel that the palm of victory should be given to the broad brushstrokes of Scripture and then science merely furnishing details to fill in. They feel that science should be given, if not an equal footing, almost an equal footing with theologians as far as understanding God's creative activity. And that has something to be said for it, although that can be very dangerous in terms of how it's handled, especially if the palm of victory is given to the scientific enterprise as controlling over Scripture. Then it can get to be very, very dangerous indeed. But you can see that there's a problem there that needs to be thought through and worked out. Now, that's the first thing. I didn't intend to talk that long to give a mini lecture on the first point. The second point that I'd like to make tonight, in the IBRI monograph, there's considerable time and space given over to the question of what God actually created originally, in terms of the Genesis kinds, the kinds of creation. I want you to understand what is being said in that monograph about the kinds that God created. I want you to get clear on that. That's very important, especially in view of some of the versions and some of the emphases that have been made in the past, which steer us not just nudge us, but steer us in a particular direction as far as understanding the Genesis kinds and the implications of the Genesis kinds. The third thing I'd like to emphasize, well, see, the second one was rather brief compared to the first. The third thing I'd like to emphasize is the question of time and that whole issue and how it plugs in to the question of what God actually did in creation. And that gets us into the days of creation, the yom, and what the yom means, and how it's used there in Genesis 1 and Genesis 2 particularly. And I've made some suggestions in the Ibri monograph and made a proposal also for a chronological structuring of the creative events and the creation days of Genesis 1 and 2. And I want you to understand what I'm proposing because it is a complicated proposal. And you may have thought that while you were reading it, saying, what's he talking about? Well, I understand that, and I want to explain that clearly enough so that you understand what I'm suggesting and the background of that in terms of other proposals and other points of view, which I didn't take the time to develop in the monograph, but which you will read about and come across and stumble over and so forth. Well, those are three things that I think are vitally important. The question of the general revelation and the special revelation and the relationship between them, the question of what God created in terms of the Genesis kinds, and the question of time as it relates to creation, especially viewing the yom of the six creative days of Genesis 1 and what each of those days included and how they're related to one another time-wise, and especially in relation to the questions bring up time constantly in geological and paleontological frameworks. Now, having dealt at some length with the first thing, let me say something about the second thing, the Genesis kinds. On page 28, by the way, were you surprised at the material under 2A on page 28? Did that surprise anybody? That is, that God, in His Word, does not specify the creation of atoms or subatomic particles, or microscopic organisms? Nothing mentioned about the creation of microscopic organisms. Nothing mentioned about monerans and protostans. Nothing mentioned about those things. Nothing mentioned about sea plants. That's kind of interesting. Or amphibians, for that matter. Or wingless birds. In the record, it speaks of winged birds, but nothing of wingless birds. Nothing of flying insects, which is very interesting, because insects really don't count as birds, even in the Genesis creation record. I mean, that's stretching birds a little too far as a term. Doesn't mention anything about disease-causing bacteria or viruses or funguses or parasites. Now, of course, those you could take as a category and say, well, those are all a result of sin, or the result of the aberration which sin brought into the created order. That's an interesting study in itself. And it doesn't mention anything about galaxies, quasars, or black holes, assuming that black holes exist, and there's a great deal of information, or at least opinion, that has been spread abroad in many writings about black holes. It doesn't mention these things. And so one might wonder, is the Genesis 1 account a complete record of God's creative activity? My suggestion there is that what we have are broad categories in Genesis 1. and in some cases even using the figure of speech part for the whole, even that. And that there are some things which would not have been understood at the time that Moses penned these words, that God simply did not specify in the record as to what he created. I mean, without any microscopes, what's the point of talking about microscopic creatures unless you might say, well, thousands of years later, we would discover that there were microscopic creatures. I don't know what word Moses would have used for microscopic creatures anyway. But thousands of years later, we could say, we discovered microscopic creatures, and Moses talked about microscopic creatures, and now we know that the Bible is true, you know, something like that, an apologetic function. I really don't think that that's necessary, and it would have been, as I say, totally meaningless at the time, and totally meaningless for thousands of years. So, if you take them as broad categories, the sum total of which is to convey the idea that God brought into being all of non-living and living reality. If you take it as that, in that way, with some specifications of categories, then I think we're on safe ground. At the bottom of page 28, it mentions what things are specified in Genesis 1 and 2 as to what God created as far as living things. And again, seed yielding herbs, seed containing fruit trees, aquatic animals, winged birds, cattle. That should be creeping. That's not a Scotch way of writing creeping, you know. It should be C-R-E-E-P, not creeping or creeping or something. Land animals and living animals of the ground, question, burrowing land animals, and human beings. Even though they're not specifically called a kind, yet I think they're sufficiently distinct to be viewed as a kind, a category of God's original creative activity. Now, I've provided on pages 29 and 30 a translation of all the biblical passages in which the Hebrew word translated kind appears. And this is all of the cases. In the Ivry monograph, of course, you saw this word, the word mean, and that's the word translated here, kind. I personally think, and I express this in the monograph, that it's a mistake to start with the disputed instances as far as methodology. I think it's better to start with non-disputed cases where you get a clear understanding of what the meaning is according to its usage and context. So I think it's best to start with Genesis 6:20 on page 29 and go on to 7:14 and then into Leviticus and Deuteronomy and then Ezekiel and get a clear idea of how the word is used in context. Not bringing to it a lot of baggage, not bringing to the study a lot of preconceptions, just trying to see how the word is used in these verses. Now, especially in the Mosaic usage, you notice 30 out of the 31 cases are used by Moses, and the other ones used in Ezekiel. So we have a fair database, although 30 categories. But you notice in Genesis 6:20, we're talking about animals that are supposed to go in the ark. And in Genesis 7, we're talking about the animals that went into the ark. And we're not talking about animals reproducing. We're not talking about animals that come from other animals. We're just talking about different kinds of animals. And we're talking about different kinds of specific categories of animals. So in Genesis 6:20, we're talking about different kinds of birds. See, that's a non-scientific, non-technical way of looking at it. Cattle, according to its kind. Sometimes this word mean is used in a plural form, Sometimes I suggest it's used as a collective. Cattle according to its kind, the cattle kind. Large category. And then creeping animals of the ground according to its kinds. Different kinds of creeping animals. Don't make it into a technical word, mean. Don't make it into a technical word signifying species or subspecies or genus or family. It's a general word which means just kinds. Kinds, types, subdivisions, categories, classifications, that's all. In Leviticus, we're talking about clean and unclean animals. Animals you're allowed to eat, whether you'd like to eat them or not. And animals you're not allowed to eat. That is, ceremonially clean and unclean animals. And you notice that it says according to its kind or according to its kinds. All that says is anything that's a vulture, anything that's a kite, anything that's given that category, given that name, viewed as being in that category, you're not supposed to eat that. Okay? Just that kind. Raven, anything that's a raven. Owl, there are all sorts of kinds of owls, you know, all kinds of owls. And nighthawk, cuckoo, and hawk, stork, heron, lapwing, bat. And then these are ceremonially clean. The locust, again, see, you might not like to eat that, but it's ceremonially clean. The bald locust, according to its kinds. That's very interesting. Kinds of bald locust. The beetle, according to its kinds. Well, that's a very large category indeed. At least 20,000 species. That's a very large category. And grasshopper, according to its kinds, various kinds of grasshopper. Well, in Deuteronomy, you have the same kind of thing going on, clean and unclean animals, according to its kind. And its kind means according to that category. See, it has nothing to do with one animal reproducing another animal or coming from another animal. It has nothing to do with one animal being like another animal. Like, in other words, it has nothing to do with a child being like its parent. A whole structure has been built on that. Again and again, it's written in the various books. As Genesis 1 says, after its kind. And that means to many people, well, it comes after it in time. So you're talking about parent-child or parent-offspring relationships, and the offspring is like the parent. And that means, as you build this structure, that no new species can develop, according to this rule, after its kind. Again, it has nothing to do with reproduction. We're talking about original creation here. We're not talking about reproduction, we're talking about production. And there's no law that states here that things have to reproduce after their kinds, meaning here's a type and the offspring have to be like the type. That has nothing to do with the use of this word here. That's all imposed, those ideas. I don't know how it got started, but it's all imposed. Now, in King James English, after its kind didn't have the same signification as the word after has today. We think of after in time. Something comes after something. We don't think of after in today's language as according to. But that was one of its meanings in King James time, as well as the time idea, after. I've translated according to the preposition with mean, because frankly that's the only way it should be translated in these contexts outside of Genesis 1. I mean, there is no possible way that you can translate luck with mean outside of Genesis 1 to refer to reproduction with the offspring being like the parents. There's nothing like that. When we come back to Genesis 1 there, where we have this record of what God originally created, again, we have to remember we're talking about original creation, not about reproduction or recreation. We're not talking about offspring being like their parents. We're talking about God creating various kinds of things. So according to their kinds means whatever is a aquatic animal or whatever is a bird, various kinds of birds, various kinds of fruit trees, various kinds of herbs God created. And that's all that it means. So someone will say, well, hey, what does that imply about the development of new species? Nothing. What does that imply about the development of new kinds? Nothing. It says nothing about the development of new species, pro or con. It says nothing about the development of new kinds, pro or con. It doesn't deal with that. It's pure mistake of the way that we understand the Old English. It's a pure mistake. Now you will notice that as far as the kinds of these, on page 30, these various kinds of living things, on page 30, the taxonomic level. Taxonomy has to do with classification, scientific classification. And you probably know, some of you, backwards and forwards, the scientific classification system, going from kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, and together with the intercalations that are often put there. So you can have an order and a suborder and an infraorder and a superfamily and you can go on and on splitting up those categories. Well, do you notice that of the things God created, they come in as far as various kinds of fruit trees as order on that level, orders of a subclass. Herbs, some orders of two subclasses. Aquatic animals, several phyla, very high up on the taxonomic scale, and a number of classes. Birds are a class. Terrestrial animals, several phyla. Cattle, that's a family. Creeping animals, a number of classes, different phyla. Well, those are all the categories in Genesis 1. When you get into Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Ezekiel, especially in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, then you get down to lower levels of the classification. Bald locust, that could be classified as species. Some even classify bald locust as subspecies, interestingly enough. You find them at practically all levels, the use of the word kind at all levels, which again should tell you that you cannot make mean a technical term. You can't say mean means species. It doesn't mean species. Mean means kind, and kind means anything from species up to phylum. It all depends on the context, how it's used in that particular context. It's just kinds of, subdivisions of, the main thing you're talking about, the main category you're talking about. It's not a technical term. And le, the preposition le before it, should not be translated after only because of the connotations that carries with it. According to is a much better translation. According to. Now, so much for that. The third thing is the time thing. The time question. Oh, yes, that's very good. The time question. Time question. Time for a break, yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Steve. All right, let's take a 10-minute break. Then we'll proceed, and I'll try to leave most of the time for questions and discussion in the second hour, together with some explanation, hopefully, in answer to your questions on that issue of the proposal of this creative aspect and creation days. All right, let's hold it to 10 minutes. and do that, make it 8:05. That's 11 minutes. Be happy to see anybody who'd like to take care of the payment for the class notes.
Isn't the creation carefully selected, basically? For instance, if I went to a football game, I was thinking, at the Eagles game, you ask me what happened, I'd say, well, Cunningham threw 3 touchdown passes, okay, and a few defensive great plays, and they lost. I wouldn't tell you every single play of the game. I couldn't tell you every penalty of the game. I guess you were the highlight.
Exactly.
But it doesn't subtract from what actually happened.
No, no, not at all.
So basically, is the account in Genesis selective for its redemptive purposes, or selective based on God's just good pleasure?
I don't know if I could relate it to redemptive purpose quite so closely as that. That'd be interesting to try, but I don't know if I could do that. But certainly you're correct as far as it being selective in regard to God's purposes.
I was listening to a tape that suggested that in the same way that the New Testament books
extra,
were written to go against a heresy, and heresy brings about these responses, that the book of Genesis in the first chapters could be responding to pagan cultures, and that's why that would dictate that selection. Of certain things. Maybe they worship creeping things.
Oh.
And suggesting that we parallel what goes on in the book, for example, that's upstairs, ancient Near Eastern text relating to the Old Testament.
Good, good.
Would give a historical, theological context if we could nail down.
Yeah. That'd be an interesting study.
Yeah, that would. I'd like to be involved in that sometime if I could ever get the time. Because there's so much interesting stuff there.
Well, the interesting thing is, as you go through theology, various things will occur to you in terms of projects that you'd like to do. And if you go on for further study, one of those might strike fire. And you'd already have a good start on it because you've already done some thinking about it and you'd start going for the research and so on. Yeah?
Because most certainly when that was written, according to the selections that are there, they had to have had meaning.
Oh, yes,
to the people.
That's right.
And it had meaning because of their context. What was their context?
Yeah.
Could have been some people worshiping this creeping thing.
Yeah, that's good. That's
to
good.
Get the Jews to realize, or maybe it's even an apologetic for the nations, that these things that you worship are created by God. Light and darkness are created by God.
That's
you don't worship light and darkness like the different.
That's very good. Yeah. Yes. And worshiping the host of heaven.
Yes.
Yes, that's very good.
All those ancient heresies.
Now you need to get excited enough to plunge in.
Yeah, I know. I'm excited enough, but I just...
Yeah, time,
my hour, if I can make my hour 90 minutes, I
know.
Can I be excited to pick the priest?
Yeah, surely.